All right, begin reading with me. We'll start with verse 27 again and go through verse 30. 27 through 30, just so that we get the context. Matthew chapter 5, 27 through 30. You have heard that it was said to those of old, "You shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you than one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell." Now, when we look at the context, notice first of all, in verse 28, if a man looks at a woman to lust for her. He looks at a woman. So we were talking about sight there. And this is something, of course, in the world today, nothing against the law of looking. That's kind of the attitude that you see in the world today. And there is, unfortunately, on both in both genders, not only a willingness to look, but also a desire to be seen. And so you've got the parading and you've got the ogling that goes on. But in this particular context, you've got this looking. So it's not surprising that as a part of that, there would be this statement in verses 29 and 30 that would be introduced by the idea of your right eye causing you to sin. Okay, so as we talk about your right eye causing you to sin or your right hand causing you to sin, the question that we have to answer in this regard is, ultimately, I actually went down, so I'm going back to my notes. Ultimately, did your right eye cause you to sin? Did your right hand cause you to sin? And it's an interesting thing that in the entirety of this this Sermon on the Mount, the Lord is making such a point of indicating that the externals of religion and faith are not sufficient. That under the new law, that it is required that the heart be right and the heart be pure. And in fact, that's the point that he's making here as well, is that that the heart is wrong. You've got covetousness. We talked about how in that text, that in actuality, what Jesus was doing was invoking, "Thou shalt not covet. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife," as an indication of the kind of behavior that is required of those who would be in his kingdom. And so in discussing that particular point, the easiest way to put this is that we're talking here in verses 29 and 30 of language that is hyperbolic. It is an exaggeration. If you want the definition of a hyperbole, it's an exaggerated statement or claim not meant to be taken literally. Now, there is a sense in which you can be literal about this. If your right eye is actually causing you to sin, and by plucking it out, you could keep from sinning, and the difference between going dying with one eye or two eyes is going to heaven or hell, then I think that's kind of an obvious thing. It's kind of radical, perhaps, but it's an obvious thing. And the same thing with the right hand. In fact, you get any appendage, if it were better for me to paralyze myself to avoid sinning, it would be better to be paralyzed and go to heaven than to be able-bodied and spend an eternity in hell. So we could kind of utilize just about any scenario that we want to in that regard. But in reality, when we're talking about the specific sin that's found in verses 27 and 28, and I think the emphasis that is being made in this section of our study in this Sermon on the Mount, the problem is not with the eye, it's with the heart. And to be just as literal as we could be, an individual who plucked out one eye, he's got another one. And he can see with the other one. So you've not accomplished a great deal. You pluck them both out, perhaps. But at the same time, an individual who's blind can lust as well. It's not just a matter of sight. It's a matter of heart. And we could say the same thing with regard to cutting off a hand. An individual who cuts off his hand, he has no hand, so he cannot, under the law in the Muslims, the real strict Sharia law. One of the things is a thief gets his hand cut off. That's a typical punishment. But you could have one hand or no hands, actually, and you could still conspire to steal. So that's not going to actually solve the problem, other than being, there are a lot of individuals, and we are this way as well, when we understand the consequences of our actions, we may refrain from doing them. But as far as that being the cause of the sin, it's not. So the hand and the eye, they're not the cause of the sin. And since they're not the cause of the sin, we're not trying to be literal here. The important lesson that we're trying to establish is that that we need to do whatever is necessary to make it to heaven. And there should not be anything that would stand between us and going to heaven. Anything that does stand between us and going to heaven needs to be removed. And we've actually looked at a number of places in Scripture where our Lord even uses family as an example of that. That one must hate his father and mother and love the Lord and lead them the enmity that would exist in that regard. You can't place your family before God. You can't place your money before God. The rich young ruler, he did that. And because of that, he went away sorrowful because he was unwilling to put God first. God has to be put first. And that's the point that's being made here. The scenario, though, is God has to be put first with regard to sinful things, that anything that might lead me to sin, I need to get rid of it. I need to stay away from it in order to keep that from happening. So it's an important lesson, but again, I think that there's a bit of hyperbole and intended hyperbole in Jesus' words in this regard. And so with regard to the specific lesson taken from verses 27 and 28, I just wanted you to note one passage in Job 31. And the point is this: when a man lusts after a woman in his heart, he's lusting in his heart. It's his heart. It's his problem. And the same kind of language is used by Job in Job 31 and 1, when he said, "I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman?" And so this is an agreement, a matter of will, to where I'm going to refrain from that. We might also add in this, because I began our discussion by noting that there is not only a practice that's common in our society of ogling, and the idea that looking but not touching is acceptable. And it's kind of an interesting thing, because that is the case except for one group. I remember a number of years ago there was a real problem on a college campus, because you had a lot of young ladies that were walking around near naked, and a lot of young men that were looking at the young ladies walking about near naked. But there was also a professor, an older guy, that made it a habit to go and sit on the park bench and leer at and stare at all the girls as they walked by. And they got very, very upset about that, because this was a dirty old man that was doing it rather than some of their classmates, and it wasn't acceptable to them. But they were still parading themselves. So the ogling and the parading is ongoing. It is important to note something, that while we do call upon women to dress modestly, to cover themselves up, not to curry such unwanted favor, the sin is the man's when that lust is present. And that's what Job is indicating here. I've made an agreement or a covenant with my eyes that I will not sin. I will not look upon that woman. And no matter what she's wearing, no matter what she's not wearing, you cannot stand before God and say, "I couldn't help it," or "it's her fault or her responsibility." When you do that, you're basically taking the same tactic that Adam did when he said, "You know, you gave me this woman and she told me to eat, and that's why I ate." And that's completely inappropriate. So that's something to keep in mind. The problem is that in our society today, it's reached an extreme to where individuals believe that there is no culpability on the part of the immodest dresser, whether male or female, when that immodest dress leads to inappropriate action on the part of the one who sees it. And we're actually, when we're going to get into verses 31 and 32 of the text, there's an interesting statement in verse 32. If you divorce your wife for any reason except sexual immorality, you cause her to commit adultery. And we're going to discuss that, but causing her to commit adultery. The adultery is hers, The fault for her sin is hers, but you can be a causative agent in that, and God will hold you accountable as well. So when we talk about we as Christians dressing modestly, that's one of the primary points to be made. If they sin, if they lust, if they leer, it's their responsibility in their sin. But if you act in an inappropriate way and bring that attention, then you have caused them to stumble in a sense. And we'll explain what that sense is in our discussion. All right? So that's what I wanted to get out in verses 29 and 30. Anybody want to add anything?
Yeah. I just wanted to restate subjects that I broached before when we first started Matthew chapter 5. Nothing we need to spend a lot of time on. But it's important to know that Jesus is not saying here that there was once a time when it would have been okay to do this as long as you didn't commit the overt act. He's saying it was always wrong. And we just saw that from Job. Job has been attributed by some to be the oldest book and the first book of the Old Testament written.
Yep.
And if men knew that all the way back to Job, then it was surely true all through under the old law. So it's important to realize. And sometimes, I think I remember I was taught this, at one point growing up, that Jesus is, he's taking the old commandments and he's expanding upon them and presenting new ideas. No, he's not. What he's doing is he's telling the Jews that you had forgotten the underlying reason for the commandments and such, and you need to remember that and go back to that.
Yeah, I think that even with regard to... Now, I do want to emphasize that these principles that he's establishing is a part of his covenant law. And we do want to point that out because one of the... And the only reason I bring this up is because there is a theory about the issues on marriage, divorce, remarriage, where individuals will make the claim that Jesus was not seeking in any way to establish his own teaching, but instead was merely commenting on the Old Testament in order to justify divorce based upon Deuteronomy chapter 24. That he wasn't wanting to change the law there. And we need to talk about that a little bit when we get into that next section. But the reason why it is worded as it is so that there might be some justification for divorce and remarriage beyond the exception that is mentioned both in Matthew 5 as well as Matthew chapter 19. It's a bit of a technical argument that is being made, but it is a quibble that is intended to basically say Jesus was not establishing anything new. He was basically explaining what was allowed under the old law. So if it was allowed in Deuteronomy 24 for them, it's allowed for us as well. And kind of peculiar when it seems there is a direct contradiction to that in verses 31 and 32, but we'll talk about that. Jerry, you were next.
Now, you've got the same commentary I have.
Maybe. I've got several. Which one are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about the new one from
the Pope.
Where he says, talking about the, says, not condemning the passing thought that comes into the mind uninvited. Then Paul Earnhardt says, the sin being described by Jesus is the calculated cultivation of desire to assist one to whom you have no right. Lingering upon that which you have no right.
Yeah.
Now that's what their explanation was. Well, what I'm saying is, hard to see, well, you look on a woman and you admire her beauty. You know, lusting after her. If you admire her, you know, and think she's beautiful. So, somewhere, where do you draw the line? That's the question. Now, when I was young, I didn't have any problem with this. Except, I remember reading this, and I think about, well, if I saw this girl over here I wanted to date, and she's going to somebody else, it wouldn't bother me to try to take her away from him. Because he don't own her. I don't know, whether right or wrong. I mean, that's just the way I thought. Well, he doesn't own her, so,
that's kind of typical of the dating.
I wasn't really thinking. I wasn't thinking about lust. I'm just talking about attraction.
Yeah.
So I'm still hard to know at what point do you lust?
Well, I do like the explanation that Earnhardt talked about, and I think a way of illustrating that perhaps could be with regard to David and Bathsheba. And I just think about this. Now, first, we recognize that David should not have been where he was. But he had the right to be in the palace, and I suppose he had the right not to go to war. The idea that, he had stayed behind was an indication of idleness, and I don't know the reason or the motivation behind that, because he was a mighty warrior and he had accomplished an awful lot previous. But this time the kings go to war in that season, he stayed behind, and he was in his palace, and I picture in my mind an elevated position, and he looks down and he sees a woman, and since she was bathing, I would assume that she had no clothes on at all. Now, so here is perhaps a beautiful, comely woman who is in the buff, and he sees her. Now, what does he do? Now, with the way men are wired, there's no doubt that there is that recognition of attraction, that visceral reaction, but he could have turned away because this is not appropriate. Could have made that same covenant that Job made with his eyes, that I'm not going to look at her. And when you say you're not going to look at someone, it's impossible to be living in the world and not see things because they present themselves before you. And it's kind of an interesting thing that some of the Catholic, during a superstitious time in the Dark Ages, there are rare references to saints that they went around their entire lives downcast, never looking up for fear of seeing not a naked woman, but just a woman, you know, because that would be, in their minds, impure. So there is that initial sight. And of course, we come across that a lot as well. I love to watch football. And there are times when we were going to high school games and the cheerleaders would have their, or the Rockettes or whatever, they would have their routine at halftime. So what do? You know, most everybody's watching them. I turned away. I started talking to someone or averted my eyes. Oh, they're out on the field. Look at those miniskirts. No, I don't want to look at that. And so you try to avoid those kinds of things. And on television, it crops up all the time. It's just the way it is. So you avert your eyes. You make that decision that you're not going to allow that initial temptation to be cultivated to the point where it's something where desire, an illicit desire, comes as a result of that. Ultimately, when you talk lust after a woman in your heart, coupled with this verse, in verses 27-28, you have already committed adultery with her in your heart. There is that indication that I want that involvement. I know I can't have it. I know the situation is not ever going to allow it. But if I could, I would. And I tell you, there are, you listen to guy talk on the radio, you know, which, again, there's some sports stations. I like to listen to reporting, and then the guy talk comes on. I turn it because they'll even have statements about that where they've got lists of women, and they'll talk about whether that individual is someone that if they had the chance that they would involve themselves with. And, of course, they don't use those kinds of terms. They use very explicit terms or very vulgar terms in that regard. Those kinds of things, that's characteristic of the way the world is. And so there's a difference between witnessing something and turning away because you recognize the illicit nature of it and seeking to even if it's not to cultivate the relationship or try to gain the person, you gaze upon that individual, and in your mind, that's what you're thinking about. And that's something that is inappropriate. That's lusting after her in your heart. And we do need to make that distinction between temptation and the sin. Desire is present in every man and every woman, but there is the ability to quell those desires and control those desires if you wish to. It's you know, when they say the devil made me do it, no, he didn't. You made the decision. The devil enticed you, but nothing had to happen. And a decision to linger, to seek to cultivate those ideas in your mind, then it goes from temptation to lust, and that's where the sin is. Best explanation I can give in that regard. As far as that line, it may be different for every man to a certain extent.
Like I said one time, when I was a young man, they just come around wanting to know if I want to get in the football pool. I said, no, I don't. No. And I said, why not? I said, well, it's gambling. Well, it's just, I said, well, it's a sin. I'm not going to do it. And he said, well, you sin every day. I said, well, I might. He said, every time you look at one of these women in here, you sin.
Got a shock.
I don't do no such a thing, you know.
But that very well may be what he's doing.
Well, I get the deal, but I mean, I've just never thought about that,
yeah.
You know. And
Yeah, there's a difference between the temptation or the attraction,
the recognition of the demon. I mean, if you've got this in the back of your head that you're out looking and hoping you find something, but if you're not looking and somebody comes along, you know, he said, I told him, I said, well, you know, I think I look at a beautiful woman, something like a beautiful flower, the son that God created.
But see, that's the argument. That's the argument that people make when they're looking at nudes and photography and painting and all those kinds of things, but the beauty of the human form. And yes, there is beauty for the human form, and the beauty is provocative in the human form, and that's why God said cover it up. Cover the human form up so that those kinds of things don't happen. I agree with you in what you're saying. The one thing that I worry about is that individuals, because they say, I'd never cheat on my wife and I'm not interested in that person, they use that as a rationalization to lust only. You know, just lust, but not. It's not merely.
Why?
It's not merely the pursuit. It's involved the continual lingering with regard to the gaze, the phrase that we use, undressing with your eyes, that kind of thing. It's a very common thing said as well, and that's the kind of thing that's inappropriate. And again, men typically.
Well, you know, I brought up at a time when somebody got a divorce, she didn't even talk about it. I mean, you didn't even talk about those people. You just kind of ignored it, you know. And I didn't know there's such thing as porno growing up. I mean, I was a grown man before I was ever exposed to it, you know. So now look at it.
Yeah, things have changed.
These kids nowadays, they're exposed to it as soon as they hit the earth.
That's a shame. Justin.
What happened?
So, you did skip that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'll get to you in a second.
Talk about where's the line, and maybe the line's different for every man, but you look at what Paul talked to Timothy, you know. And if you're sitting there and you're like, well, where's the line? Is it 1,000 feet or 1,001 feet away from me? You're probably okay. If you're looking at the line and you're like, is it 3 feet away or am I standing on it? Then you're not fleeing youthful lust.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'll give you just one, for instance, in my own life that really, it kind of shocked me. There's a young, he's a preacher actually, a young friend of mine, who was talking about the fact that he went and he worked out at a particular club. And there was a woman that walked into the club. And he saw her and she came over to him and talked for a few moments. And he excused himself immediately and left, and which was a good thing to do. But there was something about that particular lady and her looks and everything that he recognized that he might get into trouble if he stayed there and talked with her. And when he told me that, it just shocked me because I don't want to say, look at me, because it's not that way. Paul talked about, I wish that everybody could be as I am, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. But there's never been a lady that I've come across where I thought, I need to get out of here, because if not, there's danger afoot. But it was with him. And so he left. He did the right thing. He immediately left in that situation or circumstance. So that's what I meant with far as some people, some men may struggle with that a little bit more. But you're right. Somewhat, it's not appropriate to say that, you know, that kind of thing doesn't bother me, so I'm going to go to the beach and be able to look at all the undressed ladies, and it's not going to be a problem for me, because you're cultivating that wrong attitude with regard to morality and righteousness.
Boy, but you talk about being in the world. I took my kids up to FC camp this weekend and came across two women in bikini tops, right? You have to walk past the pool to get to the hotel.
Okay, I was about to say, I hope not at
camp. I didn't
camp.
See anyone there. I saw one of them at Walmart and the other one at breakfast in the hotel in the morning. And it's like, what in the world is wrong with
it's amazing where things go these days. Yes, Dick, sorry I passed you up.
It's all right. Yeah, I was going to comment on, of course, somewhat what Jeremy had talking about, and what you talked about after he got through talking there. But that in the verse 28, there's two type of looks. There's whoever looks at a woman, you know, that's, but it goes on. to lust for her. So you have the look to lust after her, and you have the look when you don't. This is what Jerry is talking about. And with Job, he's talking about the
looking for
lust type of looks, not like that shadow at all. And so there is a difference.
Okay. I think you're right. Okay, so we've had the men speak, and we're about to go on. None of the ladies said anything. This is an issue that impacts ladies as well. So does anyone want to say anything? Put any men in our place or anything about any of this? Everybody in agreement? Okay. I do like the female perspective whenever possible. But yes. Oh, Chris, I'm sorry.
What about, if somebody looks at someone they acknowledge that, or what if they remember what the person looks like?
Well, that's a part of the process of lust, which is why I said you don't have to have eyes in order to lust. Imagination can be the same as well. And I think that perhaps there's something about that in the example of David and Bathsheba again. Because I don't know how long he looked. It may have been for the entirety of her bath and she left. But then he went and sent for her. And he wanted her to come to him. And so most probably she continued to be in his mind after she actually had left her housetop.
And she knew what she was being requested for, too.
Well, yeah. I don't think that she was just completely innocent in that regard by any means. But anyway, so yeah, it's what's in your head, your mind's eye, which is often what you see becomes part of the mind's eye as well. Speak.
Okay, this is a real situation. This was a person, they were Christian, they were a Christian, and they had trouble with the sin, and say adultery, say they just was a chronic adulterer maybe.
Struggled with it.
Tried to turn away from it, but said, you know, that when they threw out that, well, in the scripture it says if you look, you've already committed the sin. So they felt helpless, pretty much, you know, trying to work through. And so a situation like that, you know, that's a process. Someone, right?
Well, there are two points to be made with regard to that. The sin, if they thought that way, they've already committed the sin. That's not so. And that's something we distinguish. There are two different sins. In this situation, there is the lust, which is as you have committed it in your heart, and then there's the actual commission of adultery. So two separate sins. An awful lot of individuals who sin by lusting after a woman or lusting after a man, happens with the men more often, but if that is the case, and they never actually go through with the act of infidelity. And there is that distinction. So two different things. Second thing, when you talk about process, I want you to just note, if you'll go with me over to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, And brethren, I do want to note something while you're turning over there. It is very difficult for a preacher or a class teacher to talk about these things. And so I want you to know that I do my best to speak frankly, but at the same time not in a vulgar sense. And I don't ever want to cross that line. If anything we ever say about this kind of thing makes you uncomfortable, then let me know what it was, and I'll try to rearrange that just a little bit the next time we talk about it. But the Apostle Paul is very frank in his discussion of the principles of marriage in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And I want you to notice in verse 2, beginning in verse 2, the instructions here. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise the wife to the husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now, you have an individual, and again, in this particular situation, here's an individual who is an adulterer. So I'm assuming there that he is married. And looking for other women. That's the problem, you know, the fact that it's outside of the husband-wife relationship. But just to be, again, frank, without hopefully being vulgar in this sense, that God intended for a husband and wife to be sexually active to the extent to where each are satisfied in that relationship. And as a result of that, then there will be no excuse, no rationalization, no inclination of a righteous individual, because he's talking about people who are seeking to live for the Lord. There won't be any inclination because there is the satisfaction of those desires in the marriage relationship. Now, what you have is a situation where an individual is not acting righteously. There is no way of fixing that. If an individual is say it's a husband and his wife is rendering to her husband the affection that is due him, but he's not happy because there's some other woman that he finds more attractive, or with a lot of men it's as a result of the fact that it is an illicit situation that gives it some appeal, those kinds of things, then it's not a matter of a lack of self-control or dealing with or struggling with a particular thing. He is, if he has that situation or circumstance where those desires can be satisfied in a licit or appropriate fashion, and he makes the choice to do it in an illicit fashion, that's just ungodliness. It's wrong. And he's turned his mind in the wrong place. And what I'm saying ultimately is, in that situation, that it's a little bit of a cop-out to say, you know, I struggle so much with it. Well, why do you struggle so much? Why aren't you turning your mind to spiritual things? Why aren't you involving yourself with your wife instead of neglecting her? Why aren't you, filling your life with situations that will help you to refrain from it? And not only that, but never allowing yourself to be put in a situation. You know, there's got to be a relationship that is cultivated to get to this point. At some type, it may not take much of a relationship. There's got to be the effort made to ask the question, and enough effort made so that when the question is asked, there is the possibility of a positive response. All that takes willfulness, it's mindfulness, it's a desire to engage in those activities. And I'm afraid that too often in this regard, people are actually, men especially, are actually just giving excuses for doing what they want to do and saying that, in effect, they can't help themselves, and that's just not so.
Debbie's point, the battle a lot of times ends up being internalized, though, right? We talk about the two sins, right? The heart and then the physical one. And if he's engaged in the physical one and then back up to the heart, it may be that he battles the heart a lot longer than he battles the physical. You could use profanity as an example. You have people that become Christians and struggle with stopping to say profanity. You have other people where it just switches. They're like, this is wrong, I'm not doing it anymore, it's done. But you have people in between. You have people that day just almost completely stop using profanity. Maybe, you know, something traumatic happens and something such, but they almost immediately stop. You'll never hear them say anymore. But the word still comes to their mind.
Internal monologue, yeah.
It still comes to their mind, and they pull it down and they don't let it out. But it comes to the mind, and it might be decades later before those words stop coming into their mind.
Yeah. So in that, yeah, process, I mean, it's a matter of spiritual maturity. In Galatians 5, there is that idea of the flesh lusting against the spirit against the flesh. They're contrary to one another. So there's that tug of war that goes on. But in Paul's explanation in Galatians 5, basically, the more of the fruit of the Spirit that you cultivate in your life, it crowds out those fleshly inclinations. And so who gets, which what gets the upper hand? And you talk about those who are very mature Christians. There are things that that they may continue to struggle with from time to time, but a lot of these kinds of sins that we're talking about never even contemplate doing that kind of thing because they have reached that point where it no longer has that appeal to them. There is no longer that tug of war on that particular issue. And the reason, and you know, just a very simple principle to keep in mind, anytime you take something illicit out of your life, fill the void with something good. Always do that. Just cram as much good in there as you possibly can, and it'll crowd out the bad, you know. But if you do that, and you don't replace it with anything good, then chances are you're going to regress.
We've moved on a little bit, but I wanted to go back and just a couple observations on Paul's teaching in 1 Corinthians 7, because that was pretty important to what you were saying there. And two things he observed about men. In verse 7 he says, each one has his own gift from God, one in this man and another in that. What he's saying is, some men, it's easier for them to resist this sin, this temptation. Other men really struggle with it. I think that's what he's talking about.
Sure.
But then he makes a statement down in verse 9, which perplexes me. He says, but if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry. But three chapters later, what does he say? God will make an escape for every temptation. So I think maybe this is, should say, if they will not exercise self-control, because the scriptures teach that every man can exercise self-control. He has to learn it. Now, the only other observation I want to make was, he's talking about maturity of Christians. We men as Christians should reach the point where we don't look at the outward appearance of a woman. We're wired, as all humans are wired. God wired us for procreation of race. So they're attractive. One will be attractive and another is not. But as a man, as a Christian, I'll look at a woman and say, that's just her face. That's not her heart. She's a total stranger to me. I don't know what kind of person she is. And on the other hand, I've known this woman over here. It's about as godly a woman as there could be, and no man will look at her because she's not attractive.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah. It's a lot of programming. Self-programming goes into it. I'll give you one example to show that it's possible. When I was in high school, early on, this was still where the students could smoke in high school. And so, you know, there's a smoking area. It's an open air thing in between one building to another. And I had to walk by 2 or 3 times a day, so I'd, you know, walk real fast. But I remember, and I don't remember who the young lady was, but I remember seeing a young lady in class and thinking she was a beautiful young lady. And then a couple of hours later, seeing her with a cigarette in her fingers and smoking as I walked by and seeing the same. And immediately, for me, the attractiveness was gone. You know, I never gave that lady a second thought. There's no way in the world that I would want to even talk to her. Because I had just this real problem with cigarette smoke. But the point is that something that was in me where that modified my view of attractiveness based on that bias or predisposition that I had. As long as we establish that predisposition to, the ladies who are dressed with a gentle and quiet spirit, which is wonderful in God's eyes, and propriety and shamefacedness and modesty in their dress, then if that's what's attractive to us, because we've programmed ourselves to be attracted by that, then we've got the kind of approach to courtship and marriage that God intended for children of God. And that's an important consideration.
Dennis, there was a slight flaw in your logic. Marriage could be the way of escape.
That's true to a point, but what if your spouse decides she wants to become asexual? Or what if she gets sick? You still got to exercise the same control before and after marriage.
Yeah, I don't think that there's... And again, whenever you see principles like that discussed, you're talking about the norm anyway,
right,
in that situation. Because, and I've actually heard this argument made, 1 Corinthians chapter 7 indicates that a person can't control himself, should get married. So, even though I don't have the right to a scriptural marriage, I've got justification, 1 Corinthians 7, of remarrying so that I don't. But the problem is, when you remarry in that situation, you're committing adultery. You know, it doesn't change the fact that relationship is not acceptable to God. So, it's the idea in all of this, though, which is where we started off with Debbie's statement, is that with regard to biological impulses, that God has given us a sufficient means of satiating that. We can say the same thing with regard to drink and eating and breathing and all those kinds of things. There are licit and illicit ways of satiating yourself in that regard. And just because that desire may be stronger in some than others is no justification for their fulfilling it in an appropriate way. And the only appropriate way is through what we'll just in shorthand say a scriptural marriage, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that is in our discussion next week, because we're at the end of our time. We didn't even get to the next point, which was what we were supposed to do. Remember, we are going through these quickly. So this is an aberration that we will allow for this week, but we've got to cover some material next week. Well, and it's going to be a little bit difficult because we're going to be talking marriage, marriage, marriage.
There's some other things that we can move pretty fast on.
Yeah.
We don't want to get too fast on stuff.
No, I know.
Talk about.
I know, and I don't mind, you know, we're getting a little bit behind as far as chapter week, but we will make that up. But if we get to where we're getting in the habit again of doing two verses at a time for the next 6 months, we're not going to get very far. So.
One more thing, Solomon warned his son about the adulterous woman.
Yep. The seductress? Yep.